the doubling of the standard deduction necessarily count that and get any benefit for the contribution. What we're expecting and what the early data would suggest is it's not that people aren't going to give. I don't think people gave for the deduction anyway, but I think the amount they give may be impacted by the deduction. And so it may lessen the amount of the gift, not necessarily whether they give at all. And we do think it will have an impact, and we hope that Congress will be a little more thoughtful about that, because we do think it's lowering the amount of total charitable dollars that are going to be ultimately contributed to nonprofits all around the country.
Well, I hope that something happens to keep things going. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Max Williams, thank you so much. Todd Baker, thank you very, very much for joining us today and helping us understand that you just don't have to be a billionaire corporation or a billionaire to be a philanthropist.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to also thank our intern, Shauna Muckle. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. Go to our website, insidewashco.org, to contact us or leave comments on this interview. This series is produced by Rick Paulson.
Good morning, good people. You are listening to yet another episode of Culture in Motion. I am your host, Michael Crenshaw. You're listening to KBOO.FM, 90.7 FM. And this is your twice monthly news show, public affairs show, talking about the intersection of art, culture, politics, activism, music, education. Today, I've got a very special guest, brother comrade by the name of Ryan Danley, father, educator, activist, comedian, a man who does many things. How you doing, Ryan?
I'm doing all right, man. How you doing?
I'm good, man.
How's your day?
You know, the day is a trip because you know as well as our listeners, we're in this unprecedented, what we could call experience, experiment, crisis. COVID-19, coronavirus. What do we have, a shelter? Where did this pending shelter in place, or did it already happen?
It's already happened. And
yeah.
I mean, I know my work is passing out folks, you know, passes to drive around if they get pulled over, that they're essential employees.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you would have told me 6 weeks ago we'd be here, I would be, you know, I mean.
Man.
It escalated quick.
So about 6 weeks ago, roughly between 4 and 6 weeks ago, as I was watching this thing, we were all watching it develop. I remember making a post, and I said, martial law. You know, on my Facebook page, do you think we'll see it this year on a national level? And I remember some people we have in common responded, and I think they were more critical of the semantics of the term martial law.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I think that you could argue, well, I mean, I think that kind of brings us to the whole sort of like dilemma of this entire situation. I mean, you know, I mean, I think it's been really easy for us to, you know, used like that term in the past, and you're like, well, what does it really look like now that they're laying it out? And I mean, you know, part of me thinks this is a great thing, but there's still a part of me that thinks that, like, where are we still giving the power to the government to overstep here? And you know, and it's like, you know, the part of me that fears our government and fears the overreaching part of it is terrified. And then the part of me that, you know, wants this virus just to end so we can get back to living our lives and doing our things and seeing our loved ones and working and doing the things that we need to do in this world and performing and gathering as people is, you know, I mean, that's not going to happen if we have a pandemic. So, you know, what does that look like for us moving forward?
Okay, so you're bringing up a bunch of different things. And I think one of the ways when we talked about our talking points for this episode, that you kind of summarize some of the things you're talking about is the gray area between safety and giving too much power to the state. So what are some ways in which people can be safe? And what are some ways in which you think people do give too much power to the state?
Well, I mean, I think clearly we want this virus to be stopped. I mean, I think we should collectively be, you know, like as like fire, or like, you know, like, or like massive amounts of water, collectively we want like the virus to stop. Unfortunately, now we're like entrusting in the system to to keep us safe. And as we all well know, the history with our system is doesn't necessarily keep people safe, and you know, and it will take advantage of it. So I mean, for me, like staying safe is staying home. I was able to work my day job from home.
Right.
You know, not, you know, keeping my list short of who I see and who I do. I don't know what you've been doing.
Who you see and who you do. Shout out to all my poly people out there. Yeah, it's a short list, man. And just even in looking at my immediate family, right? It's like we've got an extended immediate family, you know? And so there are people that are part of our family that don't necessarily live in our home, but who are integral to the function of our daily lives. And I'm sure hundreds of people listening can relate to that. And so at this point, do we, you know, if my immediate family is four people, then what about the extended immediate family? Do I not see them? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I remember growing up, you know, in the era of HIV, which is still going on, right? But just being a kid in high school, trying to be aware, and this concept, you know, and this might sound like TMI or graphic for people, but the concept of, like, if you were being sexually active, you needed to understand that each individual that you were being sexually active with, you needed to be concerned about every individual that they had been sexually active with, you know? And so looking at something like this, it's like, no matter how much I love, trust, and respect somebody's habits, do I trust the habits of everybody that they've come in sure. contact with? Is it realistic or practical or even healthy for me to be walking around mentally trying to micromanage other people's activity? And that's, man, I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope into like the sort of, you know, how we view people in general. And, you know, for me, it's like it's easy to distrust as it is. And, you know, and I think, I mean, one of my biggest concerns coming out of this is like what it looks like afterwards.
And right.
That we have basically been going through like some cognitive behavioral therapy right now of like people are dirty, don't touch things, kind of like breeding this internal like misanthrope that we all kind of have buried down in there as like part of this culture.
Right.
And when we get out of this, how do we stop that? How do right. we look at people with safety and with those things, you know what I mean? And, or do we, you know? And like with HIV, I mean, it's stuck. I mean, like,
yeah,
you know,
it's still going down.
It's still going down.
You know, there are so many things to be scared of. Anybody can look online and see people talking about that, comparing notes about and facts and figures about influenza versus, you know, different kinds of coronaviruses. And then we got to think about, I was looking at this article about copper and how copper was a natural disinfectant that killed viruses and bacteria upon contact. And there was actually a Vice article, and it was posing this question of why aren't there more copper surfaces, especially in hospitals and high traffic areas like airports and malls and so forth. And one of the figures was in there was that 99,000 people die each year from contracting infections in hospitals. 99,000, right? And so we can spin that any way we right. want, but right now there are not 99,000 people dying of a lot of other things, you know? And then we could look at drunk driving.
Right.
We could look at tobacco-related illness, right?
Eating bacon. I mean, like we are like, right. Americans are really great at figuring out a million different ways for us to kill ourselves.
Real time.
You know, and I, you know, I mean, and then sadly, a few weeks ago, I was like, you know, I mean, you grew up through Zika and SARS and swine flu and all these things that they've been, you know, the bees that were going to come kill us, you know what I mean?
The Africanized honeybees.
I mean, last year they were trying to tell us a caravan of super poor people were coming from South America to kill us.
Right.
You know what
right,
I mean? So right. like we've heard so many things that in my mind I was like, well, maybe this isn't a deal, but like, I mean, they did run out of, you know, caskets in Italy, you know mm-hmm, what I mean? Mm-hmm, you know, so, mm-hmm. And we are trending harder than Italy. So,
man,
you know,
man, damn. So, okay. So we're going to go a little bit on a tangent and just talk about something that I think is important, but I would also love it if you could share a little bit about your career, part of your career, because you're a man of many, many different focuses. And that is humor in a time of crisis. You know, I thought it would be important for you and me to have this conversation because part of your career is being a stand-up comedian on a professional level. You know, and so you've taken humor and incorporated it into not just your professional work, but how much, you know, for somebody that is a stand-up comic, how much time do you spend in the humorous part of your consciousness in order to just function?
Well, a proper comedian turns everything into a joke in their mind immediately. I think that what like a good comedian is how we can like nuancely say it so it's, you know, so it's fair, it's caring, it's supportive, you know, that, you know, but also like it's making, you know, at times we're like making light of, you know, heavy things, you know, my act, you know, I touch on race and homophobia and and a lot of different things, and you know and when you write those things and you sit down and you put that pen to paper, you got to think about every audience member this can affect and how this can hurt, you know. And how you say it. So like in a time of crisis like this, like I think it's important to keep humor alive, and I think it's important to keep people, you know, I mean, my Facebook, I'm posting 20 posts a day, trying to keep the mood light and trying to keep the thing, you know, trying to keep things up. You know, I mean, we have Donald Trump, who's an amazingly, I mean, Donald Trump jokes on stage are hack at this point, but on my Facebook, trying to keep people up, like, you know, I mean, you know, like, I am going to apply to be a guillotine operator after this. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Like that is my, you know, what do you see yourself doing in 5 years? Wow. I'm wearing the hood and no t-shirt. You know what I mean? And dropping that guillotine all day, because I mean, I feel like that's where we're at. And, and if we're not keeping that, like that light part about us, I think that gives us some better emotional footing, you know, and also make sure that we're not punching down and we're being, respectful of the fact that, you know, people are dying, and dying actually kind of terrible deaths right now.
Yeah, people are dying terrible deaths, you know, and there's this thin line between absorbing the reality and the trauma of the moment and how heavy it is, and still being able to keep going. And that's where I think humor is important, you know, for me. And it's, I think, the best humor that I've been able to consume over the years of my life has been the humor that looks directly at how dark reality is and then confronts it head on. So like what you just said, that's genius, because talking about being a guillotine operator, I can't help but to think, my mind races to, you know, we're talking about more militarization of private security contractors and police forces and all these different people who are being given more power in this society as we creep towards fascism, right? And it makes me wonder, like, what would it take to create, you know, a subcontractor network of executioners that were actually on the right side of things, according to me. Like a temp agency, right?
Well, I'll tell you, you put it together and I'll show up. I'll swing that. I'll drop that knife quick. Yeah. But it's, yeah, I mean, like, you know, what are we, you know, and, you know, and I think the idea with, like, with all humor is that there's, like, this weird twist on truth and something that you say that's kind of out of it, and we can joke around about all of these things and what this all looks like. But on the other hand, I mean, it's important that some things are getting said, and how we package it and how we tell it is going to be, you know, I mean, how that gets through to people and keeps that thought alive, whether it's through music or comedy or art. You know, art has always, to me, been the delivery system.
Okay.
You know, in my life, has been the delivery system of, like, you know, that I've most heated on, you know what I mean? Like growing up listening to hip hop and hardcore and punk rock and stuff, like, you know, the package spoke to me.
Right, right.
You know, and so I feel like with my humor and with the, you know, I'm able to speak to that and touch on those like serious subjects, you know what I mean? Like, you know, like, he wants to call it coronavirus. Well, I call him the Russian president. You know what I mean? Right, you know what I mean? Right, and that's like, you know, like that's it. Yeah, it's funny, but it's also true. you know?
So. Yeah. Yeah, man. What do you see? You know, I'm always a big proponent of looking critically at how easy it is for us to identify the problem, but how challenging and hard it can be for us to really envision and imagine something beyond the moment of the problem. When you look maybe 5 years down the road, 10 years, what do you see in the foreseeable future? What do you see long game? And what would you like to build?
Well, and I like that you use the term build, because to me, I think the place that, you know, I even put in my notes here, like the thing that we need to get to is the idea about rebuilding.
Okay.
Because even if this is like, you know, I mean, we're going to come out of this with like, you know, it's amazing how like thin the margin is for all this stuff. Because like the with just being closed down a few weeks or a month or 6 weeks or anything, we're going to lose restaurants and bars and venues and then also, like I was talking about before, the trust between us. When are we people are going to feel comfortable going to a comedy show or going to a hip hop show or going to an art gallery? You know, when are people going to feel comfortable like gathering in mass again? That could take years.
That could take a long time.
I mean, it may never be the same again. So how do we rebuild our scenes and our communities where people can feel trustful and that our kids can come through, you know, after going through such a really drastically traumatic event? I mean, like socially, like, I mean, this escalated quickly and the floors, and, you know, I mean, if you would have told me 2 months ago that we would have no stand-up comedy, we would have no, you know, like my kids wouldn't be going to school, my daughter's graduating this year, you know, I mean, like, you know, all these things, I would have told you were crazy, you know? And,
yeah.
But now we're looking at like this complete like devastation of all these things and what this looks like. So, I mean, we're going to have to quickly quit mourning what we've lost and come out with a plan if we want to make the process go as quickly and seamlessly as possible. We're going to want to plan how we rebuild our communities and rebuild our you know, the affected cultures, you know.
Yeah, and I think the unknown factor is something that is frightening. It causes a lot of anxiety, but at least I'm not going through it alone. I think the unprecedented factor is the fact that everybody, well, I can't say everybody, I can't speak for others, but I imagine more people than in most people who are alive, most people's lifetimes. Everybody in an unprecedented way, more than ever before, is going through a common experience. What concerns me is how the dominant systems that we've lived in up to this point are going to maintain their position as the crisis continues to develop and as solutions and so-called solutions emerge. Are there going to be ways in which dominant forms of oppression are maintained by current, you know, levels of privilege and wealth consolidation? And I don't know, you know, so to me, the exercise in mental health that I'm trying to observe as it comes into my mind and consciousness is, how do I allow myself to be aware of these things in a practical way, but also not spin out with fear? You know, I remember being a kid and experimenting with psychedelics and somebody saying, you know, imagine all the things in the world that are the color green, every leaf, every blade of grass, and they totally spun me out. And then they were like, that's what you're doing right now. You need to stop. So, yeah.
I mean, yeah, and I mean, and it is true. I mean, I think like you and I discussing fear, and I think this, you know, I mean, I'm, as somebody who's generally an optimist, mm-hmm. I have actually seen a lot of really goodness through this time period.
Right,
I've seen a lot more goodness than I thought I was going to see.
Right.
And I've seen more people helping each other. I mean, even in like, you know, I saw some people being like kind of nasty to a woman at the grocery store the other day, but for the most part, like grocery, you know, I worked in grocery stores forever, so uh-huh. I got a big piece of my heart there. And but I've seen people being like really kind to people working, and people, you know, and more of like, at least around my circle and like my social media circle and the people I know, more of a collective like, are we helping each other out?
Right.
And more of a, we're all in this together. And that's like, and that gives me like a weird shadow of hope, and it reminds me of like, how terrible like the conditioning to fear each other and hate each other in this world has been for us. Because really, right. when it comes down to it, there's a lot of like great folks out there that can put this together if we were allowed to.
So best case scenario is worst case scenarios. Give me, if you could, and I know you got to be able to think on the spot because you're a comedian, right? Mm-hmm. At least you're improvising when you sure. write your material.
Right.
Give me two best case scenarios. Give me two worst case scenarios.
Best case scenario is in a month there's a huge drop. There's good luck with testing viruses. Somebody steps up. Some leadership in Washington steps up and insists that we get paid. We have access to health care. We have access to coronavirus testing, you know, mm-hmm. those sorts of things. That's the best case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And that we mitigate this as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I even hate to put a time period on it because just like, but as fast as it, another great thing is that we, you know, that there is a stimulus package that supports poor people
mm-hmm.
and supports the working class who have been sent home, who can't work. My millions of service industry friends who have been sent home, you know, with little to nothing to think about or hope for the future, and that they get taken care of, and that, you know, eventually by this time next year, this is just like the craziest time we've had.
Right, right. Something we sit around the fire and laugh about.
Yep.
Something we have systems in place for so that hopefully it doesn't happen.
Exactly.
Anytime soon after this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Those are some best case scenarios. What are some worst case scenarios?
Virus continues to take off.
Mm-hmm.
This becomes 18, 24 months.
Mm-hmm.
People are living with each other and piles of it. Bodies are dying. People are, you know, there's bodies everywhere. People are dying. Hospitals are full. People aren't even dying of COVID. They're dying of the diseases because they can't get into the hospital.
Right, right.
And that, you know, the completely terrible people that we have in charge of this country right now just sort of watch this mm-hmm. burn and you use it as another money-making scheme,
mm-hmm.
you know, as they do in all of these things.
Right.
So that's probably worst-case scenario number one. Number two, that we continue to use these things to figure out more ways to be racist, more ways to be prejudiced, more reasons to qualify the fact that we don't like people,
mm-hmm.
That the people who have anxiety and depression and all of that to begin with, who are now trapped inside dealing with this, we start to see higher suicides and start to see higher marriages and relationships break up and, you know, domestic yeah. violence and things being pushed through it. And the recovery process from this is a pretty deep scar for a really long time.
I don't like the sound and the feeling. While I'm listening to you describe that, I'm experiencing a heavy feeling in my gut. The muscles on my face are changing. You know, my mm-hmm. my body language is changing because it's easy, based on what we've seen throughout history and what we see currently, to imagine the reality of that. Sometimes it's easier to imagine that reality continuing into developing what you just described than it is to imagine the alternative. But I want to say this, in that when I think about a best case scenario, Ryan, one of the things I think about is many of us have looked at the injustices that we see and felt powerless to do something about. And we've identified the root causes of a lot of the injustices as the economic system that controls the political system, that controls the military industrial complex. And we've thought about things like general strikes and how if there was a worldwide global general strike where there was solidarity amongst working people and people who didn't even have jobs but who were poor and disadvantaged and marginalized and imagined themselves as part of the working class and part of not part of the elite, you know, that if we could have some type of common understanding about the commonality of all of our experiences and could be mobilized to stop, to stop contributing to the systems in place that just dominate in a way that's at our expense for the benefit of a few, that we could actually turn things around. And so when I think of the best case scenario, it's kind of ironic because in a certain way, we're being forced to do what we haven't been able to figure out how to do ourselves. And so it's like a mind game. It's like, how do we sit with this feeling, with this sensation of understanding that nothing moves without us? And that if things are going to start moving again in any way that seems like a reflection of what privilege we did have, that it's going to have to move with us in a way that it hasn't up to this point. And maybe from that point, things could be better. I saw an article about how the water in the Venice canals was like crystal clear for once. And that's only from, you know, a few days of less boat traffic and motor traffic. You know, and we noticed the way that the air seems to be cleaner in certain places and so forth. So I think within this moment is the opportunity for us to rethink in a way that you can actually feel, as opposed to just having it in our imagination.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the ultimate best case scenario is like, what do we learn from this? You know, and what do we see? And can we, you know, be prepared for these things,
right?
You know, and you know, and how we're better together than we are. You know.
Yeah. Well, shoot, man, it's been good chopping it up.
It's been great.
On Culture of Motion. I want to tell the listeners, you and I are going to be chopping it up on a regular basis, and that this section of Culture of Motion is going to develop into its own autonomous thing as you and I develop a podcast. Where we talk about a lot of subjects that intersect with culture and motion, but even do a little bit more work to work as a team to have some guests on our show in different artistic and educational, political, and creative fields that are going to kind of reinforce some of the ideas that we're inspired by, yeah?
Yeah, that sounds really great. Appreciate you having me on here, and I really look forward to doing this more and more and, you know, giving the listeners more content and what they want to hear, you know?
That's what's up.
Yep.
Well, thank you for listening, y'all.
Thank y'all. Appreciate it.
Peace.
I'ma change my behavior, but it will take all of us. And the question is, for those that make the most money and do the most damage, how do we hold them accountable? 7 million, that's a lot of us. Critical mass of consciousness. Some wanna ask if God exists, and I can't really say that I'm positive, but I am confident that apocalypse is a consequence of thoughtlessness. Without clean water and oxygen, then the populace will not persist. The sky, the land, and mother nature is all we have, and it all is sacred. Time is now, no way to waste it. Once it's gone, then we can't replace it. What if this world is all we get? All the signs say stop, but we're not convinced. What's the hypothesis if we continue the opposite? I'm like a mechanic on a diagnostic, eyes open, trying to see the options. Increase the peace, proceed with caution, take risk, shape shit, decrease the toxins. On a mission to do less damage, limit emissions and eat organic. Refuse to panic while I'm on the planet. I'ma make a difference before we vanish. Respect it, protect it, or you don't deserve it. Look for direction, search for purpose. Figure out how to make it worth it. Go hard for the youth who will receive it. Think about the future that will leave them. Can't escape or can't fly to space. Can't even sleep, so I'm wide awake. Reflect on the
the choices and why I make them. Mostly self-preservation. The meat we eat destroys the land. How they slaughter the beasts is torture, man. If I still eat that despite the fact, think about the personal side effects. Rolling through the hood and I'm stuck in traffic, thinking about our destructive habits. Kid on the corner just drops a rapper. You can blame him, but where's the factory? Plastic raft the size of Alaska, floating in the ocean, massive disaster. Tragic, gotta do something drastic. Can't wait for the government or magic. Human race, we can't adapt, but where's the change? Is there a plan for that? Strategize and harmonize, be compatible with what's natural. Can we turn it around and wanna burn it down? Get an old growth for a herd of cows. I heard about that in 82. Learn about what acid rain can do when that's not sustainable. It's not debatable, same capacity, not available. Self-annihilation is not explainable. That's a violation of what I came to do. Share life, spread life, I'm prepared to fight. With more bloodshed, ever make it right. They dropping bombs when we can talk it out. Take a look around, see what I'm talking about. Conservation is a conversation, but not at the expense of the population. No justice or equality, with destruction of the ecology. Can't put my trust in policy, when most of the economy is based on waste and exploitation. So the change is with the choice I'm making. Harmony between human beings, respect for nature and all living things. Drinking water straight from the stream, imagine something so pristine.
Here we are now.
Portland.